The following content is provided by MIT OpenCourseWare under a Creative Commons license. Additional information about our license and MIT OpenCourseWare in general is available at ocw.mit.edu.
That's a 10 to the minus 19th power difference, right? if you take your... So, I mean, it depends on what units you use. But you need to stick to a setup unit and be able to crunch your number with the right order of magnitude. That's, as a researcher or engineer, that's the expectation. You should, those basic numbers, order of magnitude, that should be in your head. Yeah, it's the 1.5 hour. There's no extra time, you know, the after the 2:30, the other class will come in, so we have to finish on time. Okay, any other questions?
Could we type up that sheet?
Yeah, you can type up. We can do whatever. Yes?
I know that on your midterm example you post on the web, doesn't cover to chapter 5.
Right.
So do you have anything that's more?
That gives me a chance to make some problems, right?
So what chapter does the exam cover?
Chapter 1 to 5.
Then there's a sample exam that you did?
I don't remember. Probably, I would guess probably to chapter 4, but I don't really remember. I have to look at it. Okay, so the exam covers chapter 1 to 5, the end of today's lecture. And I'm very surprised this semester I'm on schedule. Most of the time I'm behind. That's probably because I want to read my book. Okay. Okay, so let's recall what we have been talking. If you don't have a sheet, pick up a sheet. What we have been talking in the last lecture, it's also on the web. I just wanted to remind you, give a reminder I already put on the web. So in the last lecture, we dealt with one interface and two interface, or even multiple interface problems. And the lecture before, we started dealing with the issue of reflection and refraction. And we continued in the last lecture, but we emphasized more, say, in the case I have multiple interfaces. So if I add one more interface, so I have medium 1, medium 2, and medium 3, you can see that represents a lot of situations when you have a film. You have the film besides two different media, sandwiched between two different media, that can represent the case of where you have a thin layer of film on a silicon substrate. If you do microelectronics, that's very often seen. And if it's a glass, a lot of time when we wear a glass, it has coatings. Actually, I want to go back to this glass because they have 1 year warranty of the scratch, and now I saw two scratches there. But the fact is, these coatings, thin films, are used everywhere. And what you would say is, when you have those multiple interface, you have multiple reflection, and the multiple reflection create the familiar phenomena of interference. So if I plot the reflectivity or transmissivity as a function of film thickness, if you look at the way we plot it is n times d times cosine theta and divide by lambda 0. This is the phase times 2 pi. And what you say is really a periodic variation of transmissivity. And this is the familiar interference phenomena. So if you deposit the film on a substrate, different thickness, because of the wavelengths, for different thickness, different you will reflect a peak of different wavelengths. So you see different colors. And the other phenomena we emphasized is, well, if your angle of incidence is larger than the critical angle, right? And we know if I have a single layer of interface, there are cases where I have a total reflection, but in that case, I have an evanescent wave, high in exponential decay on the other side. And if it turns out, if this evanescent wave that exponential decays, so if I draw exponential decay function, and before it dies down completely, the residual ones, if we can propagate inside the third media, it will become a propagation wave again. So in that case, when you this dies down, is typically happen in the range of one wavelength. So when you bring your third medium close to the first interface, you can have tunneling. And in that case, the total internal reflection doesn't happen anymore. It's just to say some of the wave actually goes through. So this is the second phenomena we mentioned. That's the tunneling phenomena. And tunneling happens not only for electromagnetic waves, but it happens for all those interference, and tunneling happens for electron wave, electromagnetic wave, acoustic waves. So at the end of last lecture, the tunneling I gave, if I have this barrier, potential barrier, we solve the issue problem of reflection, and we know that when the energy of the electron is below this potential barrier, which is U, then if there's only one interface, there's a total reflection, or the reflectivity equals 1. But there's an evanescent wave function at the other side, exponential decay. So if I bring my third medium, so now this is a medium 1, medium 2, medium 3. Okay? And this second medium could be vacuum. That's as long as it's very thin. And so in this case, I could get the evanescent wave doesn't decay to 0 yet, and they can have some transmitted. And this transmissivity could be approximated. This is just an approximation. As 16 potential height minus E energy divided by U squared exponential 2 K 2. This is a K is the magnitude of the wave vector inside the second medium. That's 2m U minus E divided by H bar square. So this is a very small, very large number of K vector. And that means the D, when D is small, only when D is very small, you can have transmission. And now let me just show you why I want you to remember the number. So put in the number. Okay? Let's say if you have, I just take one electron. Okay? If I have one electron, I just take a simple case, one electron volt, so 1 volt potential. Okay? That means the energy, 1 volt is electric field. So the energy is, if you convert the energy, is 1 electron volt. So that is 2 times mass of electron line 10 to the minus 31 kilogram. Okay. And if I just take an order of magnitude, the potential minus the energy of the electron is 1 electron volts. How much you remember in terms of SI unit? Okay, 1.6 10 to the minus 19. And then H bar. Okay, so it's about 1 or 1.1 10 to the minus 34 square, 68. Physics people remember atomic unit, that's much easier. So I put a lot more binary code into my brain by remember this exponentials. So this is a, you can go to estimate, this is 3119 minus 50 power, 68. So that's 18, that's 10 to the 9th power, square root. 9 to 1.61 square, that's about the 4 or 5. So this is about 4 10 to the 9th inverse meter wave vector. Okay, what does that mean? If you have tunneling of electrons through one electron volt barrier, and this gap here, if you have reasonable transmissivity, that gap has to be very small, right? If it's one angstrom gap, if D is one angstrom, okay, that seems to exceedingly small. That's 10 to the 10th power. So you can see then you got the exponential less than 1. You got the reasonable transmission going through that gap. If you go to 100 angstrom, that transmission already dropped to very small number, right? So what does this, this seems to be useless then if you just don't really think hard. But in 1986, a Nobel Prize given to Benesch because he used this effect to invent a scanning tunneling microscope. So Benesch was just graduated from graduate school, went to IBM for interview, and the manager also got a Nobel Prize, asked him the question. This is Royer. He wants to look at the surface of crystals. He couldn't measure. How could he measure surface of crystals? Okay, surface or angstrom level roughness or electronic structure. I don't remember. I don't know what exactly he asked, but he was asking, imposed this question during the interview. Okay, and Benesch came up with one clever solution. And they demonstrated this scanning tunneling microscope in 82, and they were awarded 86. So you can see, normally, the last Nobel Prize at MIT, when did he do his work? Did you read the newspaper? About 30 years ago, right? He waited for 30 years. He knew he should get it, but there's always a waiting list. But you can see this is clearly a very important invention, right? Otherwise, he won't get it in 4 years. And the idea is very simple. He wants to measure surface, okay? So this is the surface you want to image. And he brought a very small tip. This is a metallic tip. As one side of the electrode. And then there's a gap between surface and the tip. And that's like, say, this is three-layer structure. Layer 1, layer 2, layer 3. That's your three-layer structure. And then you can think about the tunneling. And this gap must be, if you apply, okay, this is your sample. If you apply a voltage between the sample and the tip, you can see the current will be very sensitive to angstrom level variation, right? Because it's an exponential function. And so what they do is they put a piezoelectric stage, and piezoelectric, they know this voltage motion of crystals can have sub-angstrom resolution. So now they could adjust the height or scan laterally at the angstrom, sub-angstrom steps, and they, every step they measure the current. So if you have, really, let's magnify, if you have the atoms here, okay, the electronic potential will be different on that surrounding, either in the core or the between the atoms, right? or if you have a bumpy atoms there, just one bump there. And the K is, you will get, just based on that number, you get angstrom level sensitivity. So with that, they could quickly really image atoms. And it became a very powerful tool. Lots of labs have it. And it's not like transmission electron microscope. We talk about transmission electron microscope in chapter 2 when say electron waves, right? And that is a very big stuff. You need a kilovolts to X-ray electron and go to do the imaging. But this one is just a desktop, very small box, or sometimes you don't need a box, and then you can start doing high resolution image. So you can see how he got Nobel Prize, and so many people use it. Very powerful tool. So that's the principle of scanning tunneling microscope. Or STM, and of course, once you have the first idea, the other idea, a lot of idea came up. You can further explore the tunneling. You can think about the tunneling optical waves. So there is this invention of scanning photon scanning tunneling microscope, where you can create. So how you create a evanescent wave for photon, you can take a prism. You can think of this as a quartz glass prism. You know the refractive index, and you know the angle of at a certain angle of incident. This surface, if it's perpendicular, it's below the critical angle. But so once they hit, so you get into the surface, and once you get into the surface, this incident angle is now above the critical angle, so all the light will be reflected, right? But there's a exponentially decay optical wave, evanescent wave on the other side. So now if you have a particle here or if you bring an optical head here that has a different refractive index, it can tunnel through. So you can have originally nothing, no light comes out. A particle would cause some light out, or a small tip close to the surface will suck the evanescent wave, just like sucking it out, so it makes it propagating. So that's the photon scanning tunneling microscope. And there are different kind of microscope. It's generally called the scanning probe microscope. The probe is your tip or glass. And Binish, he could have won a second Nobel Prize, except he already got one. And in 86, he took a sabbatical. He's at IBM Zurich. He took a sabbatical in Stanford, and there's also IBM lab there. And they were troubled by the fact that they couldn't measure the dielectric material, right? Because this one, scanning tunneling microscope, need a conducting surface so that it can pass current through. So he was thinking how he could measure the dielectric insulated material and came up with another clever idea. And the idea is extremely simple. He said, okay, this is a dielectric surface, and he put a sharp tip in contact, and he make a cantilever. I mentioned this before, this atomic force microscope. It turns out, again, you can do back of envelope. That's why I want you to remember some numbers. It turns out the atomic the spring constant between the atoms, okay, is pretty high. So that means that when you have maybe a cantilever flexible enough, you will not just scratch out, break the bonds of the atomic bonds, right? So he make this silicon cantilever. If you see an atomic force microscope, this cantilever is typically a few microns thick. But at the time, he just used aluminum foil. He cut a piece of aluminum foil and make his cantilever and glue a diamond to the tip here. So that diamond has some corners very sharp. That's his tip. And he could then, at his time, because he know STM, so he can measure, if there's an atomic bomb, he can measure the deflection by putting another STM and measure the tunneling between the STM and this aluminum foil. So when he scanned this cantilever on the surface, if there's a bump, and he can measure that bump deflection. And since this is the principle of atomic force, it's a very light name, right? That's probably reflect why he recognized where this atomic force really come from. You don't need atomic force, but he recognized the spring constant between atoms can be very strong, right? So even a single atom may be pushing up your cantilever rather than being scratched off by your cantilever. But the principle itself, the deflection of the cantilever, doesn't really say it's anything atomic, right? And so since his atomic force microscope invention, people have developed more clever ways to measure the deflection. They just shoot a laser beam and measure the deflection of the laser beam. Because even though that deflection angle can be very small, but if you put a detector further away, that angle times the arc, the length, give you a relatively large displacement of laser beam. And that can be easily measured. So that's typically commercial one, just is built with a reflector laser there. So that's the atomic force microscope. And actually, even before that, when other ideas of image surfaces, using the scanning tunneling microscope, but they don't use really as a tunneling mode, they build a thermocouple. Okay? So a thermocouple, small thermocouple, they want to measure the temperature of the thermocouple because of the dielectric here, there's a heat transfer. So this is actually IBM, another IBM invention. They do the thermal, scanning thermal microscope. And then people have further developed the, say, rather than using scanning tunneling microscope, you put a thermocouple at the tip of an atomic force microscope. So you can do both topology and thermal mapping. But just a word of a warning, if you do thermal, it's very quantitative measurement is very hard. Topology measurement is very easy because any topology unevenness directly deflect your cantilever. And now if you want to measure thermally, and then what you measure is not, you can think about, okay, now this is the surface you want to measure, magnified. And now you got a thermocouple here, and you can see as you scan different area, different place. Here is this contact, but once you go to this place, it's this side is contact. The contact area is constantly changing. And because of that, you can your thermal signal is really a lot of a topology signal. Or if you do electrical measurement, you got a similar problem. It's not very straightforward, but doing topology image is very straightforward. And atomic image, a lot of time you need an ultra-high vacuum to do this image. So that's the you can see there's lots of these effects that normally are not important became very fascinating, very interesting once you get into nanoscale. In fact, the tunneling phenomena, there are more than one Nobel Prize awarded. The other person that got Nobel Prize is Isake. He's a resonant tunneling, so he has double barriers. So he invented a diode based on resonant tunneling. Okay. And talking about this, another extension. This is a tunneling phenomenon. It can be based on one layer, and here, like a double barrier, you have two layers. And we discussed the multi-layer structure. And one common multi-layer structure is one, two, one, two repeating structure, optical coatings. If you do optical experiment in the lab, you use this structure very often. And this is filters. People use optical interference filters to select a certain spectrum of light. And we talked about the transfer matrix method in the last lecture. We didn't go to the detail, but the principle is there. You use that principle, you can calculate the if you have a wave comes in, and you can calculate reflection and transmission. And we know if you just have one single layer of film, you have that interference effects, this reflectivity periodic. And you see similar phenomena, except that you see more prolonged of the interference bits. And in this case, what you can get, if you see the as a function of thickness or wavelength, and this is reflectivity, and this is 100% reflection. And you can get 100% reflection. So this is typically, I'm not drawing very exact, I have examples in the book. You can get certain region, not more than one, okay? Certain region, you get a perfect reflection. In other region, you get perfect transmission. Even though each individual interface can maybe only reflect weakly, maybe only 5% reflectivity. But once you add up a lot of those layers, they add up together. Because the physics is going through one period, going back, this reflection here. If you design such that you got your face going through this extra distance is 2 pi, or 4 pi, or 6 pi, right? So in that case, area of this reflected wave here, going back here, is adding up. Because a factor of 4 pi is 1. So you add up all this reflected wave, and you can have constructive, destructive reflection. So because of that, it turns out that here, one period must be half of the wavelength, one period. Because your round trip is... gives you one wavelength. That's one period, right? And then each layer is a quarter wavelength because one period including layer one and layer two, right? So that's quarter wavelength layers. And so those are the, in optics, it's very often used, very well known, Bragg reflectors. Okay? Yes?
That only works
for certain wavelength range. Okay, and Bragg reflector are widely used in optics because you can get a nearly perfect reflection. So those passing, those are the stop bands. Those reflection means no light passing through the field structure, and then this one that pass through is the transmission band. Okay, so reflection 100%. This one are also called stop bands. Okay, so those in optics are very well known, familiar phenomena. And that comes back to, I want to make the connection. And here, I said that Isaki, he got a Nobel Prize for his double barrier. He could get another Nobel Prize. I think, again, that's rarely happened, right? Nobody really get two Nobel Prize in physics, or you can get a Nobel Prize in physics and then go to do chemistry, maybe you get another one. This is Marie Curie, Madame Curie. She got two Nobel Prize. And so this is an optical wave. It's not more than 100 years. Okay, people do coding all the time. And what Isaki, you read his paper, right? Isaki and two has this paper of super lattice. What that super lattice is? It's a multi-layer structure, periodic structure for electrons, right? So rather than doing this barrier, he said, let's make those periodic barriers by depositing alternating thin films, right? That's his super lattice. He made the layer 1, layer 2, layer 1, layer 2, and the autoradiant potential. And this is the autoradiant. If you draw a refractive index, that's the autoradiant refractive index. And this is the autoradiant electrical potential barrier. And again, when your electron going through this barrier, you have passing band and you have stop bands. Right? And that translates. This is actually this the model we talked about for electrons, chronic pinning model. Right? And that translates into the band structure. That's the band structure we talked about for electrons. This is the region where you have that stop bands. No electron wave allowed inside. No photon wave allowed inside. Everything reflected. Right? So here, your band gap, your mini bands, is the effect of electron reflection. Okay? You can see the connection. When people deal with it, different fields may start with different ways. When you do optical interference filter, you do the transfer matrix method. That's most of the time people use. When you do the electron periodic potential, you use the Bloch theorem, and you do the band structure calculation, right? But the wave behind it, the phenomena, is very similar. And so this is the electron. You can think of super lattice as an electron filter. And similarly, there are also experiments on super lattice on Fourier wave, acoustic wave. So Fourier filters. There are names people call Fourier filters. And that's the same acoustic wave propagation through periodic structure. And but this is more challenging for electron Fourier. Here is the optical wavelengths. Optical wavelengths, visible, 0.5 micron. Electron wave, you go to check the wavelengths, wave vector we just calculated, right? Now, wave vector give you order of magnitude of wavelengths. Depends on the effective mass. It's 100 angstrom. So you got to make your film, quarter wavelength is very thin, right? So the technology-wise, this needs a lot more development. The concept was there. Then people start to develop in molecular atomic layer deposition. That's an MBE. Then it can be demonstrated. Now, again, you have read the other papers. I want to make all this connection. You see the picture come together. So this is a one-dimensional periodic structure started with optical waves. I said it's more than 100 years old. People learn to do the coatings. Very long time. And then in the end of 1960, that's Chu's paper, Isaki and Chu's paper around the 70 or 71, they proposed this periodic electrical potential, super lattice, right? Because naturally given is a crystal structure, three-dimensional. They just make the one-dimensional, periodic repeating in one dimension. So that's something new. And then in the 86, you read Yablovich's paper, right? It came back. Okay. What electromagnetic wave, there's no three-dimensional structure. The one-dimensional structure, everybody knows, Bragg reflector, more than 100 years, right? Then 86, he said, let's do three-dimensional structure. Let's make this quarter wavelength we design in 3D period. And that's his name of photonic crystal. In that case, the photonic crystal is not an atom. Not a real atom. It's this quarter wavelength structure or whatever different refractive index material you put in at each lattice points. Right? And by doing so, he's mimicking electrons in real crystal because nature has given us real crystals, few angstrom apart atoms. He's mimicking real crystal that form electron bands, photon bands, and now you got a three-dimensional crystal form photon bands. Right? So things came back, analogy came back to a circle. And now you go to check how many papers in photon and crystal. Lots of papers. It's interesting. But when I was at UCLA, Yablovich is a professor there. Was one exam, and there's another professor who just doesn't buy into the limbs. What is a photonic crystal? It's just three-dimensional Bragg reflectors. Okay? He's right, okay? But don't overlook the power of thinking differently, analogy. And that's, you can say, at least in writing this book, I try my best to putting things together and hoping to have some stimulation by putting things side by side. So those are the by now we have answered one question that I imposed at the beginning of this chapter, and the question is how to calculate the transmissivity. Remember, when we want to do deal with transport, I said I have 2 points. Point one, point two, and I want to calculate how much heat is going from point one to point two, and I can calculate how much heat is going from point two to back to point one. Right? And in doing so, what I need is, okay, I say Q1 to 2, what I need. If I look at the heat, I can look at charge, I can look at momentum, I can look at the particle number. All this is similar. And if I look at the heat, I say each quantum state has this energy E, right? And then this is the distribution for, because I'm looking at the point E1, point 1. So I put the E1. I'm looking at this quantum state, how many photon, how many electron, how many photon. That's what the distribution function gives us. And let's say I deal with a temperature T at that point. And I put the TE, I will come back to common. There's a very subtle point. Okay? So I put the TE1. And so this is how many photon, electron, or photon at this quantum state at that temperature. Right? How much energy they carry, and then how fast they propagate. If I want to look at, so from 1 to 2, if this is my z direction, so my velocity should be velocity in the z direction, how fast they propagate, right? And then how much of that going from point, that at point one, how much going from point one to point two? That's the transmissivity that we have been dealing over the last few lectures. We say this is the fraction, how much that going from point one to point two, that's the transmissivity, how much reach there. Right? And this is per quantum state. And if I want to know all that's possible, I just sum up all the quantum states. So this is a wave vector kx1, ky1, kz1. That's at point 1. This is something that we did when we do specific heat. We sum all the quantum states. Right? And if I have different polarization, for example, electromagnetic wave, I have 2. Electrons, I have spin 2. And photons, I have 3 polarization, optical, I sum up all that. Okay? So this is counting all possible. Okay? And I get, because here I am doing heat flux, if I do watt per meter square, you will see I have to divide by per unit volume. This will give me per surface area, because this meter per second divided by volume gives me per meter square per second. Per meter square per second, this meter square, that second gets into the watt. Right? So this will be my counting from point 1 to point 2. Now I have talked about how to calculate 0.1 to 0.2 transmissivity, right? I have talked about how to use quantum mechanics to calculate the energy level. I have talked about the statistical distribution so that you know how much fraction of what's the number of photons or electrons at that quantum level. I haven't talked about how to calculate how fast they go, which I hope I can get to it this lecture. But let's just take this as a long. This is, if you don't do energy, if you don't do heat, you replace this energy by charge. That's your current flux, right? And then you put it as a 1, that's your particle flux. Or if you put it as a mass of per particle, that's the mass flux. You do this flux, all the flux you can think about, you can write this way, right? And if I do not have this two, I would get the local energy density. That's when I did this chapter four. Local energy density, specific heat. Take the temperature derivative, I get specific heat. What I add in transport are these two quantities. How fast they go, in what direction I'm looking at, and how much is going from 0.1 to 0.2. So that's the thing I built. I'm building this thing layer by layer. The rest is math. Okay, from here the rest is math. And you remember when I do the energy or specific heat, the math I use is convert this in using density of states. Right? Convert the summation into integration. And that part of conversion I want to master. But here there are some subtle difference. And again, let's think about conversion. Let's say this is all the function that I want to sum for, because each kx, ky, kz, each set of kx, ky, kz give me a quantum state. So I do point sum of this function, right? Now if I say this is the function, this is a whatever function I plot here, and I do only 1D, kx. And what I'm doing when I do the summation is I'm summing up the discrete values. That's what I do in this summation. What does it mean? I'm summing up that discrete value. But what I know is kx, what's the separation? It's 2 pi divided by L. That's the separation between the wave vectors, right? Okay, so each of this is a 2 pi divided by L. Area of this are equal 2 pi divided by L. So what I do when I do the, I can do an integration if this function doesn't vary sharply. I say this area is my area 1. This is my area 2. So I want to replace this summation. So after I get the area, I divide by this length. That's the height. Right? So that's how I convert this summation into integration. I convert it into a triple integration. Everything else, I just write it the way it is, E1, TE1, VZ1, tau12. And then I convert that KX1, KY1, KZ1 into the integration, DKX1, DKY1, DKZ1. But then I have to divide by the separation in each direction. So what I get is 2 pi divided by L cubic. Right? This is the volume of one quantum state. This is the number of this volume in the k-space. Volume of one quantum state, that gives me number of states. Right? In this small volume. Okay? So here I have, that's why when I define density of states, I like to divide the volume. I put the volume because this volume cancels this volume. Okay? So that's what we did. If you recall, when we do a specific heat, we convert the whole stuff, including a summation. So including this summation, I put it here. I define this as my DE, density of states. So I convert K into E, right? How do you do that conversion? Let me just focus this part, right? I write this part is just a 4 pi k squared dk and 8 pi cubic volume cancel, right? That's just rewriting that this factor here. And that's, so I define, when I define my density of states, I say I do 8 pi cubic dk, dE, and dE. So this one is my dE, density of states. So what density of states is helping me convert that integral into an integral over energy. Original integration is in the kx, ky, kz with density of states, and now I do integration in energy. Or I can, if I define per unit frequency, I do integration in frequency. I can define whatever most convenient. That's what we use when we do the specific heat. But as I said, there is a subtle difference. And when I do the transport, I just have to be more careful. When I do specific heat, this doesn't depend on direction. These two terms, right? The specific heat is these two terms. Or total energy is these two terms. The velocity depends on direction, and transmissivity depends on direction. Right? When we do the single layer interface, different angles have different transmissivity. So when I convert this directly into spherical coordinate, into k, that k is the magnitude of kx, k squared, ky squared, kz squared, I have to be more careful to look at direction. I just can't do symmetrically into whole sphere. That's the caveat when I do this transport. So what I should do is, now this is a Cartesian coordinate for kx, ky, kz, or z1. I want to convert it into a spherical coordinate. But I want to convert it more carefully, so I don't do a, because this is a symmetric case only. So now I do a spherical coordinate. This is my kz1, and this is my kx1, and this is my ky1. So if this is the k direction, that's the propagation direction. I define my angle. This is theta with z direction is theta, and with the xy direction is phi, right? So can you tell me this is a k? This is the magnitude of the radius is a k. If I do dkx, dky, dkz into k theta phi, what I should do? From Cartesian coordinate integration to spherical coordinate integration. dk x1, dk y1, dk z1. When I convert it into spherical coordinate, what I do?
Dk sine theta d theta.
Dk sine theta d theta d phi k squared. Do you all get that part? Do you get this? Huh? K squared. Dk, d theta, d phi. Right? Do you know this transformation? No, you don't. No, some of you don't. Okay. You need a differential volume in K space. And this differential in spherical coordinate, you can say if this is a k, this length, what is that length? This length is the radius, this arc length, right? So this here is k sine theta, and this one is d theta. So k sine theta d theta, that gives you this length. And this length, this arc, is a... Oh, this is d phi, I'm sorry. Okay, k sine theta d phi gives you this arc length. And this arc length is k d theta. Right? K d theta times k sine theta d phi gives you k squared d theta d phi. Right? And then the volume increase in this direction is dk. So dk, that's a differential spherical volume. Okay? You can also define solid angle. A solid angle is just defined as this area, dA, which is just the k sine theta d phi d theta. So it's k squared sine theta d phi, and divided by the radius square, k square. So this one is just sine theta d phi. So what I have here is I can just write as k square d omega, that's the differential solid angle, and times dk. Okay? So this is how solid angle. Solid angle, you asked the question before, what is solid angle? Solid angle is an angle of area suspended in space. The polar angle is the angle of an arc suspended in 2D. Right? So that's the solid angle. And then if you look at the derivation here, our solid angle is really defined for k. Right? At each point of x, y, z, I have a set of kx, ky, kz. So now I got this, I do this transition more carefully. As I said, I don't do that d 4 pi square. I convert this into a spherical coordinate. So what I have? Here I write, come back to write that q from point 1 to point 2 is integration. And now I have the first integration is, I have triple integration, right? I have this one k theta phi. So I have integration over phi is 2 to 2 pi d phi, right? 2 to 4 pi. That's the what point I'm looking at. Point 1 to point 2 I want. Okay, here. I'm defining my angle. I want to cover all the angle in this plane perpendicular, that's 2 to 2 pi. And theta, okay, theta, I'm looking at going from point 1 to point 2, right? So anything going backwards doesn't have any possibility getting there. It's only positive theta. So if you look at this point, this is my kz, right? And this is a kx, this is a ky. So only the theta is between this from here to here. That's, if I look at the solid angle, that's only half of the positive solid angle. Everything can go potentially from here to here. Right? So that means my theta is 0 to pi d theta. And then I integrate over k, which is E1 F E1 T E1. And VZ1 tau 1, 2. And here I have k squared dk. That's the integration I want. Yes?
Since we have converted, shouldn't VZ1 be something like V at theta square root or something like that?
Yeah, I have to do my conversion. So, because you can say what I gave here is energy, right? This is energy, this is energy. This may depend on direction, may depend on energy frequency. This may also depend on direction, energy frequency. So I have two choices. I either convert into K, or I convert into energy. And both are fine, depends on what you are dealing with. And if you convert it into E, you do this. So this is something like your density of states, right? That's your density of states here. And I forgot, there is this A pi cubic. A pi cubic. Right? The volume cancel. And there is also this P sum of all polarization. Okay? And this is a concept I don't feel that I don't want to impose on you, but nobody, because not any other book discuss. I would say this is more like a differential density of states in certain direction. Because I have this direction is defined by my theta and phi, so I put this one and this together as my differential density of states. And this differential state, density of states, if the medium is isotropic, then in each direction is then the density of states you derive divided by 4 pi, because the solid angle of the whole space is 4 pi. So most of the time, I just stick density of states divided by 4 pi. That's where it comes from. It's really for isotropic medium. So the reason now, you can see I tried to go carefully from the summation of quantum states to transform into integral, because this is the type of thing, if you do really any research, you would encounter often this type of transformation. And the rest I'm going to go faster. So given this, you can say it's from point 1 to point 2. You can do the same thing from point 2 to point 1. Right? Because this is only telling me how much is going from point 1 to point 2. I can write a similar expression from point 2 to point 1. I'm not going to write that down. I assume that you can see there now. Write that down. You can see what is from point 2 to point 1. And you can just change your quantity. You change your quantity to the point at the point 2. So E2, TE2, VZ2, tau to 1. Everything just from 2 to 1, but local quantity I.2, right? So you want to find out that your net heat flux from 1 to 2, or particle flux, or charge, you just do 2 to 1. That's the difference. It's a Lambert. Once you understand the basic, the author is just doing correct counting. Okay? So this is the math you need to do. And now you can see I got two quadrilateral integrals, right? From point 1 to point 2, I have an integral. From point 2 to point 1 back, I have an integral. And there I'm going to tell you a trick. And this trick is at equilibrium, the left flux must be 0, right? If there is no temperature difference, no voltage difference, a medium that has a uniform temperature, the going from point 1 to going to 2 must equal to point 2 to point 1. It's true in all cases, as long as your system is in equilibrium. Right? So, when at equilibrium, I have Q1 to 2. If you look at the Q1 to 2, it really depends on temperature TE1, right? It doesn't depend on temperature TE2. I don't have anything in my expression here. So, but at equilibrium, when TE1 equals TE2, so let's say I can take any of that equilibrium value. Say if the whole system is all at TE2, then I must have this TE2 equals Q2 to 1 TE2. That means both points and every point in the system is at that equilibrium temperature or chemical potential, right? And this gives me a way of eliminating one of these two integrals. Because when I do this summation. So here I get Q1 to 2 TE1 minus Q2 to 1 TE2. That's what I have here. These two points are different. But I know this one must equal Q. So I write TE1 must equal to same Q1 to 2 TE2 because that's my equilibrium. If I have an equilibrium, this one must equal to this one. You see what I'm doing? Right? And now I change everything into 1 to 2. You go back to say, if I say have everything 1 to 2, the only difference is this term is different. Every other term is the same. Right? So what I can do is, based on that, I'm going to write this as Q12 now equals, I copy everything, sigma p, and let me just write that symbol. This double integral, 0 to pi, 0 to pi, d theta d phi into my symbol of for solid angle. I just say this is my lazy way of writing that integration. Okay? D omega, d omega equals sine theta d phi. And then here I have my expression for if I convert it into all E1. So I have E1, V, Z1, tau 1, 2, F, E1, T, E1, J minus F, E1, T, E2. And density of states divided by 4 pi dE1. I greatly simplify because I only do one integration. And this is the so-called principle of detail balance. One example of the principle of detail balance is Kirchhoff's law. In thermal radiation, in radiation, we know Kirchhoff's law. What it tells you is that emissivity equals absorptivity at each frequency, each angle. That's an example of detail balance principle. And it's very useful because you can see, well, which side should I choose? Should I choose side 1 or side 2? It's up to you. Which one is simpler for you? You choose that side to do your mathematics. Yes?
How did you apply the equilibrium condition to the heat flow, saying that
heat flow
would announce the temperature? Saying that the temperatures could be different
with heat flow. I am not applying that. I'm applying this, the fact that this term here, right? If I assume, if the system is at the equilibrium, it will be the same as this term. Now, if the system is not at equilibrium, I have this term that's different. That's what's real emitting. This is the reverse going back. The reverse going back is always, that term is always as if my system is at equilibrium, that should equal to here.
But I thought the equilibrium assumption also meant that the temperature is T.
That's, say, this one equals this one. This TE1. This is originally my TE1. Now I said if that point, if point 1 is at, rather at the TE1, is at the TE2. So now these two points have the same temperature. That's an equilibrium system. Think about it. Okay? So this is a way of very useful, the detail balance principle. And I went to conference, I say people don't know this basic. Okay? Just say, how can I balance it? This will give you at the equilibrium, okay, everything is let zero. If not at the equilibrium, otherwise you get some transport there. Right? So this kind of formulation of calculate flux, here I wrote down heat flux. You can do current flux. You can do mass flux. And it's really looking at the transport, it's really from point of how much transmissivity, what's the transmission from point 1 to point 2. This way of doing the transport calculation is called the Landau formula. Landau formalism. Next chapter, we're not going to do Landau formalism. It's very convenient when you know how to calculate transmissivity from point 1 to point 2. Okay, and this is only useful if there's no internal scattering, only surface scattering, and you can treat your wave rather easily than multilayer structure. Once you get the internal scattering, it's much more difficult to calculate that. So this is useful really in a lot of nanostructures. And from here, let me give you a few examples. And the first example is I'm going to apply so the phenomena rather than very details. The first example is I have an interface. That's what we've been dealing the whole several lectures. I got an acoustic wave coming in. This is side one. This is side two. I got a reflection. Right? We know there's an interface, there's a mismatch between the two materials, you have reflection. You don't have 100% transmission. Right? So I apply that formula. I can calculate heat flux. So I can calculate the heat flux between point 1, 2. My point 1 is this side of interface. My point 2 is the other. This is 1, 2. Doesn't have to physically pop. But I know on the two sides, because the interface difference reflection, my transmissivity is not 100%. Right? So I apply that formula to exactly just using this. And now if TE1 is mass TE2 is not large. Okay. By saying not large, I can do mass simplification. I can simplify this two function by differential, Taylor expansion. So what I get then, I can expand this term as dF dt TE1 mass TE2. So what I can write this as a K 1 to 2 TE1 mass TE2, and that equals R 1 to 2 TE1 mass TE2. And this K is conductance or thermal conductance. Right? So the units will be watt, meter square, Kelvin. And this is a thermal resistance, thermal boundary, because I'm dealing with the interface. Or in that sense, maybe you should call this a thermal interface conductance or boundary conductance. Right? So this is the unit then is a meter square Kelvin per watt, inverse of that. So what does that tell you is that either interface of two different materials, you have a thermal boundary resistance. Okay? And if you look at this thermal boundary resistance, how much was the order of magnitude? This is what? dF dt times E times tau. No, not tau, I'm sorry. Times the density of states give me the total energy. Right? Not total energy. Specific heat. This term gives me density, specific heat. So the order of magnitude of thermal boundary resistance is a specific heat times the velocity. Transmissivity, let's say, is between 0 and 1. Right? So the thermal boundary resistance or conductance, order of magnitude is specific heat times velocity. A specific heat, again, this is order of magnitude. I mentioned before, for most materials, it turns out specific heat is of the order of 10th power per unit volume. Per unit mass is very different. Per unit volume, it doesn't vary much, factor of few. Within one order of magnitude. A specific heat velocity of sound in solid is 10 to the third. So this is typically order 10 to the lines meter square Kelvin per watt. But most of the time, this is conductance is smaller, it's 10 to the eighth. Okay, 10 to the eighth to 10 to the nine. Okay, it's very big conductance. But what does it mean? Let's take a slab of film. Just a normal thermal conduction through this slab. Okay, so what's the thermal resistance of this slab? Does anybody remember thermal resistance formula? If this is the length, okay, the area, the thermal conductivity. Okay, mechanical engineer will remember that. Thermal resistance is K. L over K. Okay. So you can plug in and say, because at the end of what we want is specific one. Specific is 10 to the minus 8th, because the inverse of that, 10 to the minus 9 or 10 to the minus 8th. And this is L over K. Here is a watt, meter Kelvin. Meter square Kelvin per watt. And so here you can see if K is 100 watt meter Kelvin, that means L is 10 to the minus 6. So that's correspond. If you have 100 micron, if you have a thermal boundary resistance 10 to the minus 6, you have a material that corresponds to a material with 100 watt meter Kelvin, 1 micron thick. Now if you got those super lattice only 10 angstrom or 20 angstrom, that will become dominant. In thin structures, the thermal boundary resistance is dominant. Big structures, you kind of can forget about it. Okay, now you go to, this is intrinsic. This is because of the wave reflection, right? Even you have perfect material. Now in reality, the thermal boundary resistance could be much larger. That's because when you meet two materials, they don't get a perfect contact. And in that case, you get a much larger thermal boundary resistance. And that's not intrinsic. You can think about the ways to solve it. But if you can solve it, you become rich. Okay. One of the big problems in this, nowadays is you see computer chips, and then you slap a heat sink there, and it's because here, the interface material. You put the interface material, right now you put the silicon grease or this try to fill in the cracks. But that is not good enough. A large temperature drop happened there. I got to see a lot of companies just keep asking, do you have a solution there? Okay, so that's more extrinsic. That's where you can think about what kind of technology, whether you can develop technology to help. And that's one application. And second application I want to talk about, of course, here I'm talking about photon. You can think, if you're an electrical engineer, you think about the electrons. Electron goes through the interface and reflect. You got equivalent, not a temperature drop, chemical, electrical, static, or electrochemical potential drop. You got additional resistance for your electron flow because some electron reflected back, right? So this is the importance of interface. Now we learn tunneling. I talked about the Lowbury Prize winning work on tunneling. And you can do a little bit more mundane, but still very interesting. And this is when they, you can think about radiation heat transfer. So I have material 1 going through, separated between material 2, right? And if you do this in radiation, maximum black body radiation heat transfer between the two surfaces, what is that? Sigma T1 force Palmer. That's what you get the maximum. Right? But in that case, the maximum, there are some of this wave could not come out, frustrated. They're lame, frustrated waves. Total internal reflection. They're different lanes. Okay? And you got a tunneling, evanescent wave here. So when you bring this surface close, this will tunnel. That means you increase your heat transfer. So if you measure this as a function of distance, you will get a curve like this. Maybe here you, I shouldn't plot this way. Probably. Right? You can get a maximum, if this is a normal material, a maximum, if this refractive is n, this will be n squared. N squared times higher than black body. If n is a 3 refractive index, you get a factor of 9 higher than black body. Because at the end, when the two surfaces touch each other, the black body density of states inside is higher by n cubic. Velocity is lower by 1 over n. N. So the product gives you n squared, increase in the heat flux. And, of course, if you talk to Alvin, he's doing something better than that. You got a surface wave, and in that case, the surface wave is not limited. The density of states is much higher than this n cubic. So you can get even much higher than the n square effect. And that's the surface we were talking about. So this is an example of radiation heat transfer. And the other example I want to mention is the quantum conductance. Okay? And if you have a wire between two reservoirs, okay, probably I should draw it a little bit tapered. This is one, this is two. Okay? And this two reservoir could be, this could be a point. And this two reservoir could be two conductors. So you apply a voltage there, you measure electric conduction. And you go to do your Landau formula. You calculate the electric conductivity. And turns out that for each quantum states, or each channel, you will get a conductance, electrical conductance, is 2E squared H. H is a Planck constant. So it's a universal. It doesn't depend on what material you put there. So what you do is you will measure this jump, discontinuity in the current goes through step. When you go to excite more quantum states, you get the steps in the conductance. So that's the electrical conductance. And if you measure thermal, there's also, all these are universal. They call it universal conductance because it doesn't depend on material. And the thermal universal value is pi squared kb t and 3h bar, h. Okay, so all those are called universal conductance. It's independent of material, and you can all derive this from the Landau formulas. Just by assuming transmissivity equals 1. Everything, one channel, just goes through perfectly. That's why I draw a tapered one, because otherwise you got a reflection. So when people design, they design more carefully. You should ask me a question by this time. Give me a challenge.
This is true for
really large temperature gradients?
I'm sorry?
Is the Mandel formalism true for really large temperature gradients?
Landau formula, when you have temperature gradient, it becomes much more difficult. It's more temperature difference. Because the gradient means you have a local scattering. Once you got a scattering, you can calculate this transmissivity easily. Now, I give you a problem. What happens if transmissivity equals 1? Now, this thermal boundary system case. Come back to thermal boundary resistance. Whoops, where is it? Thermal boundary, transmissivity equals 1. That means there's no interface there, right? Everything come in, go through. Okay? Right? Now you go to apply this formula. This is 1. It's not 0. The delta T is not 0. Because when if you look at it, the thermal boundary resistance is not 0 when transmissivity is 1. That's just this integral. So that means when I flow heat through at the interface where there's no interface, I just imagine there's an interface, apply that formula, I got a delta T there. I run into trouble, right? You read Lidl's paper, he was discussing this. He tried to say, well, you have to have one mean free path, right? And the true trouble, you can solve this problem. And the electrical engineer, they also got this problem. Okay, depends on what kind of situation you're dealing with. And the problem is, I'm using TE1. You look at all the formulation, I'm using TE1, TE2. Those are only the represent whatever the distribution going from forward, this point 1 to point 2. So it's only going half of the distribution, right? I don't care about the other half. Now you have reflection. So if this is a TE1, and here is a reflectivity FTE1, 1 to 2, and here is transmissivity FTE1. And similarly, you got the other one coming FTE2. You got the reflection, you got the transmission. At each side, you don't have an equilibrium distribution. This is the forward. Equilibrium is isotropic. The backward may be very messy because it has a transmission, reflection, different distribution as a function of frequency. You don't have equilibrium. Okay, now you can say, well, I go to sum up, I found out what's the local energy here. I sum up, I say, what's the local energy here? And corresponding to that energy, I go to say, what's the corresponding temperature? That's a equilibrium temperature. And that I would get a T1, I get energy as a function of temperature, I get a T2. That T1, T2 is different from TE1, TE2. So you have to be very careful what temperature, what electrochemical potential you're using in your definition. Fourier law uses this one. So if you're using Fourier law for the rest of this region, and using thermal boundary resistance, you should not use that formula I gave. I have in my book more detailed discussion. And if you do electrical transmission measurement, this kind of thing, if you apply the if you say you can measure electrochemical potential at that 2 point, you should not use this. Because, again, same problem. The fortunate thing is most of the time your electrode is very large. What you measure is actually, in the electric case, you are measuring what comes towards the interface. So there are cases you can do that measurement. Okay, that's all. And if you don't have a sheet of